This episode and all of our South by Southwest coverage is brought to you by Vimeo, the new home for 360 video.
Hi, everybody. This is Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Renee Felice Smith and C.A. Gabriel may have higher profile industry experience than you or I do. Renee has been a lead actress on one of TV's most popular shows, NCIS Los Angeles, for 8 seasons, and C.A. has composed commercial music for high-profile brands like Chrysler, Kraft Foods, and Jose Cuervo. But when it comes to making indie films, they're in the same boat as we are, trying to make their vision a reality with limited time and resources. And in fact, they may be even more fiercely committed to independence because they're normally beholden to the creative visions of their bosses or clients, which is something that many of us who have day jobs in the industry can relate to. The pair has collaborated on some short films, but their first indie feature as co-writers and co-directors is The Relation Trip, an utterly charming film where an entire relationship accelerates from meeting to marriage to breakup over the course of one surreal weekend. In the film, Renee also plays the character of Beck opposite Matt Bush's Liam. In this episode of the No Film School podcast, you'll hear my conversation with Renee and C.A., or Chris as you'll hear us call him, from South by Southwest, where the film premiered earlier this year. I think you'll really enjoy hearing about how they took everything they've learned on other people's sets and parlayed it into their own film that they made with their best friends, and especially how they used low-budget practical effects to make their weirdest fantasies real on screen, including the decision to spend 6 whole hours out of a 16-day shoot on an 11-second stop-motion animation. So do you two want to introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about your film?
Sure.
Great.
C.A. Gabriel. I co-wrote and co-directed and scored the film.
And Renee Felice Smith. I also co-directed, co-wrote, and acted in The Relation Trip.
And the film is a high-speed romance. Mm-hmm. Two millennials meet at a party and decide to go on a friend trip. Mm-hmm. It is hard to
say.
It's
a tongue twister.
and kind of swearing off relationships. We don't need to rush into things. And then they do. And over the course of a 3-day weekend, we get to see them go through all the stereotypical relationship tropes. And and it gets really wacky really quick.
I think you summed it up.
You both come from other roles in the industry. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious about what else you do outside of co-directing and also what you then kind of brought from those roles into the director's chair.
Sure. Like you said, we both have day jobs, I guess. I work on a show on CBS and CIS LA, and I've been a series regular on that show for the past 7 seasons. This is season 8 of the show, and that's been incredible, and it also has afforded me to pursue other projects. We made 2 short films together before this feature. One of the films we produced was here at South by Southwest in 2015. And I feel like for me, my job, you know, being on set has become a mini film school. I ask all the questions. I'm not the type of actor who just wants to be told, like, okay, here's your mark. Like, and then, you know, sit down. I really want to know what's happening. And I ask the DP all the time, Victor Hammer, what's happening, why he's lighting something a certain way, and, you know, what we're, oh, we're swapping lenses, oh, we're, you know, we're, is this, and I always look at the shot, where I feel like sometimes, you know, as actors, we can get really lazy and just kind of rely on other people to tell us what's happening around us all the time. And I really have tried to do the opposite of that and just try to self-educate on set. And I think that has inspired our work and, you know, kind of allowed us to work.
Yeah.
Actually, before we jump into Chris, now I'm really curious, what's something that kind of jumps out that you, a tip that you heard from the DP or something that you...
Well, it's interesting. I really pay attention to all of the shots that we're getting for a scene. So we had a director once, and I remember my character was in a hotel room, and we were entering the hotel room, and it was all on Steadicam, and he was getting all of my reactions to what I was seeing in the hotel room. Basically, I had to look for a briefcase and open up the briefcase and get something out of it, and I was dressed as a maid, and you know, it was like an undercover op, basically. My character gets to do that sometimes when she's not in front of the computer. But I remembered thinking, and this is maybe right after I had done my first short film. And it's funny. So I remember he was getting all of my reaction shots, and then we were cleaning up, moving on, everyone was moving on. And I kind of raised my hand and I was like, hey, you know, I think I talked to the scriptie or whoever was right next to me. I said, don't we need, like, from my perspective of the room, how is this going to cut together? If it's just me looking around the room and the camera's on me, don't we need the reverse? Like, do we need to see like my POV? And that was the first time I remember feeling like, oh wow, I know what's going on around me, you wow. know, like, oh wow. And then she mentioned it to the director and he's like, oh, we totally knew that. Oh shit. So he was like, wow, thanks Renee for saving my ass, kind of a thing. But for me, it wasn't, I was like, oh wow, I know what's happening now. You know, it was like, it was validating for me, you know, as not just an actor then, like as a filmmaker, just to know what's happening around you on set is, it's a challenge when you're first starting out. I mean, it's a circus.
But it's empowering too, I imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what it was. It was empowering. And the more time I spend on set, the more I speak up and the more I assert myself and the more questions I ask and, well, why'd you do it like this? Well, why, you know, I've always been that student. I've always asked way too many questions in math class, you know, but I think your questions become your strength and, you know, they give you vital information.
I mean, we're no film school. Like, we're all about that.
Exactly.
Learning from practical experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Learn from your own, you know, you can teach yourself.
And I should say, when we were making our first couple of shorts, Renee had just had this experience where she started to understand. Mm-hmm. And I remember learning from Renee what she had learned. And that, for me, sort of lifted the hood. And then it was the first time that I kind of saw how, like, oh yeah, this is actually how it's
how
made.
The pieces.
And then once that door opened, there was so much more learning. Cause then I would just, I just absorbed, I just watched. And I, you know, once you understand a little bit about how films are made,
you can
expand on that so quickly. Mm. But for most people, the people that, the biggest fans of movies, like the general public who really appreciate the magic of movies, which I have always been that person. Mm-hmm. Once you show that person a little bit of how it works, I mean, you can learn so much so quickly. And that's kind of what we did. We lifted the hood and then we just went, we went nuts and we watched things and we took notes and we read about it.
You're also, you've always been super self-educated with composing. Mm-hmm. So Chris is a composer, his day job.
Right. So to answer your earlier question, I am a composer and I work mainly in commercial music. So advertising music, very short jingles,
car
commercials, tampon commercials, you name it. It's
wow.
It's,
how
but
do
it's
you
really,
score a tampon commercial? Like, what does a tampon sound
usually like?
Like?
They're usually like super sexy.
Ew, no.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, like super sexy empowerment. That's usually, and then you're like, always, you know, that's the vibe.
Oh my goodness, yeah. How strange.
Yeah. Okay. Chris will read the breakdown to me sometimes, and it's just, it's so funny the way they describe the sounds that they want to hear to match up with the product.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, what is the project? What is the product? Oh, okay, it's a tampon. I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. It's very funny.
Anyway, sorry for the departure, but that's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is fascinating. But so that is, and I love it. I love my job. I love being able to do something drastically different every job. I can do, you know, like an epic trailer score for something, and then the next day I'm doing EDM, and then the next day I'm doing blues, and that's really fun. And that, you know, it made me become really prolific and much less precious than I used to be with music, Which also, I mean, that has also translated into making this film, the idea of being prolific and not being precious and really using your parameters to create something and not worrying about, well, I wish we had this, I wish we had that, mm-hmm. but here's what we do have. Here are our Lego pieces. Let's make the best possible thing we can make with these pieces.
And you do that in your studio all the time with, like, the score. Actually, Chris uses a lot of, like, made instruments if he doesn't have it, or if it's out of reach and, you know, you can't get one or you can't afford it. Chris will, like, find a way to make one. So he's actually made, like, this steel guitar because he wanted this certain sound and certain things like that. And in our film, the score, Chris learned to play the theremin, which is this, like, insanely complicated instrument. And you feel like you're, like, talking to aliens when you are playing it. It's communicating with aliens, I should say.
Yeah, it was, I mean, and that was just, you know, and like I said, the whole idea of building an instrument was that same principle went into the special effects in the movie. It was the same thing. It was, we want to achieve this goal. Mm-hmm. So how do we do it just with our hands and with our friends and in a room, just like brainstorming and, you know, using either trick photography or some practical effects or makeup. Mm-hmm. That's really fun.
But it's interesting, like, talking about this out loud now, and seeing how, like, our day job really influenced the way we approach this film. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting because, like I said, you're so self-educated. Although you went to music school, you didn't learn, you know, the programs through music school, right? And you didn't learn to play the theremin in class. You know, it's kind of the way indie film gets made, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to make it, you'll find a way.
Mm-hmm. And I should say the other, another answer to that question about our day jobs and how that affected the movie is that we both do a certain thing for our jobs. Mm-hmm. And there was a need for both of us, or a desire for both of us, to do something that was innately us, right, which we're for years, you know, have been carrying out another vision, which is great and we're super grateful for, but there is something, and I'll just speak to the score, there is something about what, you know, what I did musically for the movie, nobody ever would have let me do that for their project.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was weird, I made weird choices, the theremin blankets the score, and because we thought that was such a cool sound and sort of set the film apart and gave it that eerie vibe, but also still comical. Mm-hmm. But other directors or other producers wouldn't have been into that. It's a scary thing to say, choice. I'm going to make these weird sounds all over the film.
Yeah, it's a bold choice. And I think that's what we were both after. We didn't want to, like, shy away from these decisions. You know, we wanted to lean into them. Mm-hmm. And
you don't have to when it's your film, right?
Exactly. You don't have to shy away. You just, yeah, you make what's innately you, mm-hmm. I guess.
I was also wondering, Chris, if, like, there's something about your musicality, like something that comes from composing that helped, like, pace the film or, like, helped with the way the film kind of plays out.
I think so. And we spoke about this a little bit last night.
That's interesting.
Personally, my music, I started as a songwriter and then I got into composing, but I have this struggle as a composer where it's very hard for me to write something that's longer than 3 minutes long because I have this Beatles aesthetic. I have it's pop, it's verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, out. And there's no fat, there's no extra parts that you're like, well, what does that mean for the song? When I listen to music, when I listen to scores, and then I realized when I watch films, it's the ones that are straight through all necessary information or all necessary imagery that I think that is how that translated for me, where when we were writing with our third writer, Dana Scanlon, there was a big part of just trimming and cutting out fat. Mm-hmm. And we wanted the movie to move very fast.
To parallel.
Beside the fact that we like that aesthetic, but we wanted it to parallel how quickly these two people are blasting through this relationship.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, so I think that does, that does sort of come from the, that music side and that pop side.
Yeah. I will say that, the music with the film is completely different with temp music. Obviously, mm-hmm. we received our first assembly from our editor, Eric Wilson, and it just has a completely different feel. Mm-hmm. And it did feel disjointed, and it didn't have the flow that it has, that we think it has now. And I think the music is a huge part of that.
I understand that you guys are co-directors and co-life people.
Yes.
So I'm curious. I mean, I'm always curious about how co-directors negotiate on set, like, who makes what decisions and kind of who's in charge and how does that work? And, you know, does it get confusing? Mm-hmm. And in your case, you've got the added level of like your interpersonal dynamics. Mm-hmm. So how did you decide kind of how things would go on set?
I think Chris and I really share a very kind of scary, similar aesthetic. And generally, obviously, as you pointed out, we're kind of color coordinated and that was not on purpose. But yeah, so I feel like that has enabled us to generally be on the same page with major decisions. Mm-hmm. And so it makes working together, you know, make sense.
A lot of it is pre-production, is prep work.
Oh, yeah,
before we got to set. We, Renee and I drew, we sketched cartoons essentially of every shot that we knew we needed to get just for our own sake, that on the day it was essentially our shot list, but we're visual people. So we drew the sketches like from the doorway with the mom's legs. And when we put it in this big photo album, like very like 80s style, like grandma's photo album, we have all of the cards in it.
Yeah.
And actually looking back after we made the movie and we edited it, we went back and looked at those cards and it almost reads exactly as like the film. We got every shot that we drew, and there, some of them are like spot on. Yeah. It's really, really cool.
Well, I'm like such a visual person. I'm a visual learner. And Chris, actually, in heading into pre-production, we were like, how are we going to organize ourselves? Also, because I was acting and in almost every scene, we needed to have it mapped out for us. So we weren't making decisions on the fly. I mean, of course you do anyway, but you need to have that roadmap to set yourself up for success and to carry out your vision, you know, to assure that you have all the pieces that you need to then put it together and make the film that you set out to make. Mm-hmm. So you were kind of resistant to the drawings at first. We didn't have, you know, a professional storyboard artist. It was just the two of us scribbling, but it really helps with, you know, just having a visual shot list. I would much rather a visual shot list. Mm-hmm.
While we are so alike in a lot of ways, that is something that we do differ a little bit innately, is that Renee is very prepared. And Renee's a very good student and always has been. So the shot list, the storyboard.
I don't know about that, actually.
It's true. The storyboard was Renee's idea. And at first I was resistant because I was like, I just don't think either one of us are good enough at drawing to do this effectively. But we did, and we powered through, and we spent a really long time on it. And the drawings got better and better.
The thing is, it's not about being perfect, right?
Right.
It's just about visually understanding and conveying that then to your DP, to your camera operator, who will be carrying out your vision. Mm-hmm.
But I should also say, while I was saying that, you know, that's not normally how I am, I usually have always felt more comfortable on my toes and in the moment. So I think those
not
two...
Not directing your first feature.
Oh, totally. No. And that's what I mean. That's why, where I was going with that is that, you know, I can't imagine having directed this movie without Renee. Right. And because we have those different skills, because we have those different skills where I'm comfortable, you know, on my toes or making, you know, decisions on the spot, and Renee is so prepared, that both of us kind of complemented each other and we're able to be a better director than either one of us would have been on our own.
Right. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Aww.
Life happens in 360 degrees. And now on Vimeo.com, so do your videos. Now you can upload, watch, and even sell your 360 videos on Vimeo. Vimeo 360 means immersive eye candy, immersive adventures, and immersive storytelling from the world's best filmmakers. Plus, Vimeo has tons of helpful resources for all experience levels. You can learn how to shoot, how to edit, and even get roundups of the best 360 video gear. Join the new home for 360 video at vimeo.com/360.
So I want to jump into the fun stuff a little bit. I don't know how much time we have, but, you know, how can we not talk about your practical effects?
Please.
And you did talk about them last night in the Q&A, which was really exciting. So I guess the first question is just like a more umbrella type question. I wrote this down because you said last night at the Q&A, Renee, you wanted to push and escalate the surreal moments in the film. Mm-hmm. So talk about that sort of decision making. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, what I'm talking about is that you think you're watching a sort of typical romantic comedy, and then a bunch of like weird shit starts to happen. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually feel that it's not that jarring, actually. Mm-hmm. So talk about the decision making, and then I'd love to hear some of the nitty gritty stories about how you pulled some of it off.
Sure. Well, I'll just say, like, from an aesthetic, you know, standpoint, we grew up with, you know, films like The Labyrinth, films that make use of puppetry and are really imaginative and convey these emotions in a different way.
And I should also add, films that did that before we had
visual effects.
Yeah, before we had computer generated effects. So these were so old, like Labyrinth is a perfect example. It's all, I mean, the trickiest thing that they do on there is green screen work. Mm-hmm. Everything else is either like eye twisting set, you know, mm-hmm. sets that use perspective mm-hmm. or puppetry, which, and that is, all of that stuff is real. And the mm-hmm. people that are acting with it are mm-hmm. in the space with it. And it's just, it's sort of something that stopped being used or has not been used as much, mm-hmm. but we, you know, came up in the, with the films that use the that 80s. And those were so real to us,
80s.
You know?
Yeah. 80s films. Mm-hmm.
Labyrinth is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's
one of ours,
probably
too.
My all-time favorite movie.
Yeah. And so we were really interested in approaching transformation, these kind of transformative moments in this way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also a huge fan of Charlie Kaufman mm-hmm. and his use of the surreal. So that's really where we go in our minds. Mm-hmm.
Because we were dealing with this high-speed romance, this relationship that they were rushing through, we, Renee, myself, and Dana, were looking at the relationship tropes, the things that, the milestones that you hit in a long-term relationship, and this could be marriage, life. Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, well, it's Friday in the movie, mm-hmm. and in Friday, we need to get them to from A to B. Mm-hmm. So the way that we immediately went to is like, well, let's make it surreal. Like, let's get there in a symbolic way. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously thinking a symbolic way that we, and then also how do we do it practically?
Also, right. And also because it's a visual medium. Mm-hmm. I just think, let's show, don't mm-hmm. tell, show, don't tell, show, don't tell. And so we got into the mask work. There's a breakfast scene where Beck and Liam literally pull each other's faces off mm-hmm. and they're finally honest with each other after that. So it's kind of like shedding that, you know, exoskeleton, that bullshit layer that we all put up in the beginning of a relationship mm-hmm. Where we want to be the perfect versions of ourselves and we really want to please the other person. And after that comes down, they're able to be honest with each other, I think, for the first time. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of...
Yeah. So one more thing to that, too. I am such a cartoon junkie.
Yeah.
And was growing up in the 90s, like the golden age of mm-hmm. like cartoons and Nicktoons. And in that medium, it costs the same amount of money to have a character float around a room mm-hmm. than it does to have them sit in a chair and talk. So they don't, that's never...
There's no limitations in animation.
Yeah, there's no budgetary limitation. It's all the same. It still has to be illustrated. Still has to be animated. So for us, we just go there. We go straight to the, let's pretend we don't have to worry about what it costs. Wow. Like if we were watching this as a cartoon, what would happen?
Right.
And that's sort of where we started and then went to, now how do we do it?
Right. So to clarify, it's not an animated film.
It's not.
But you use these practical effects. So talk about the mask and kind of like what it took and what, how did you do it?
Yeah. So we worked with a visual effects makeup artist, Stephanie Ruiz de Chavez. She's incredibly talented. She's worked on several, she's been basically assistant to a very big visual effects makeup house for a while. So this was her baby. The relationship was also her first feature on her own, which was really special that we got to share that and give her that opportunity. So we made life casts of mine and Matt Bush's face. That process was very cool. I mean, I've seen videos, you know, Jim Carrey doing his life cast for the mask.
6 hours in the makeup chair for the Grinch.
Yeah. And,
like, what does that mean? They put some goop on your face and...
Yeah, basically it's this, it feels like rubber cement on your face, really. I found it extremely relaxing. I felt like it was a day at the spa. But Matt had a little bit of a different experience. I think he felt kind of claustrophobic in it. But also, guys don't do face masks. They're not used to that, you know? I'm like, yes, all of it, give it to me. But basically, she created this mold of my face. And with that mold, she created the latex mask that we peel off of each other's faces. She also painted those masks so that, you know, they had all the details, my eyelashes, you know, my freckles. She had it super duper detailed.
And then we broke, when filming it, we broke it into
a
couple of stages. So when they first start pulling off their masks, it's just a thin layer of latex. So we have that, you have that feeling that they're pulling skin away.
It was only on the forehead. So it looked, it was literally our faces and just a tiny patch on the forehead. Mm. And then in a series of cuts, we built it up so the full mask was on the face. But we wanted it to look as realistic as possible. Mm-hmm. So we had to kind of cut back and forth between, you know, the initial pull of the small piece of latex and then eventually the full mask.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what about the cocoon? Describe kind of what it is for people that haven't seen the film and then.
Yeah, the cocoon is the moment after it's the first very, very honest scene between Beck and Liam when they really do
connect
and fall in love with each other. And right after that scene, they're laying in the hammock and it turns into a cocoon in a very like time-lapse-y stop motion sort of butterfly metamorphosis style, which is what we were watching many videos of as we were thinking it's definitely going to be stop motion, but what do we want it to look like? Mm-hmm. And that idea came in the writer's room. Mm-hmm. Renee said,
guys, I think I was like, I just like stood up and I was like, oh my God, guys, they go into a cocoon and they come out married, you know, just to catapult them into the next stage of this relationship. So, and visually, oh my God, how cool would it be to show two human beings falling out of like a giant cocoon? Mm-hmm. So that's where we went with it. And then we enlisted the help of Mind Fruit, Damon.
Who are a stop motion team.
Yeah, stop motion team, Cassandra and Damon, incredibly talented duo. And they were up for the challenge. Mm-hmm. We said, guys, we don't have a lot of time in our schedule. You know, we shot the whole film in 16 days.
Wow.
Yeah. And 11 of those days were in the desert, 97 degree weather. And that's, you know, at 8 a.m. And so, we had to just figure it out. And with layers of burlap and the ripped paper, the brown paper, the netting, we transformed this hammock into a cocoon.
So you two were literally lying in a hammock wrapped in burlap and stuff in 97 degree weather.
Yeah. Luckily that was at night. So it wasn't, it was, you know, the drops in the desert. So
it was a little bit cooler.
Yeah.
But we, Matt knew we were doing this stop motion. Matt is the lead actor, Liam. He knew we were doing this stop motion thing. He didn't know too much about it. We had mentioned
He loves to say that he found out the day before, and he said it in the Q&A last night. That is just not true.
But it does make a better story.
Yeah. we're not cruel people.
Right. So we had talked with this stop motion team, and we had said, you know, we were trying to figure out, well, really the only way to do this is to have them in it. They have to be in the cocoon they have to be in the hammock while we're making this cocoon. There's really no point where we can get them out of it to then continue the stop motion because it changes the shape of everything. It wouldn't work. So we originally they said it was going to be 6 hours in the cocoon, mm-hmm. which we were like, that's a lot of time. And, it wound up being about four
hours and like 18 minutes or something like that. But for me, I, again, much like the life cast, the mask, I absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. It was like being two little bunnies in like a little, you know, like garden hole in the ground. It just felt like so peaceful. And everyone was like working around us and we could hear their conversations. And it was, again, I really enjoyed the process.
Yeah, it was really fun. And so then technically the way that we did it was we put them in the cocoon. We put all of the layers of the cocoon on top, on first, and then we worked backwards because it's much easier to shoot stop motion taking things away mm-hmm. than adding them on. Mm-hmm. So we got them all in there. It took about probably about a half an hour to get all of the layers on in the way and the pattern.
You figure that out, right? Like the reverse, like going in reverse.
I don't know.
It's a blur. But I think that was part of it. You're like, I know. We'll go in reverse, and then we'll be peeling layers off so you won't have all the layers on for very long.
Right.
That was part of it. With, like, breathing, which you need to keep doing.
Yeah. And then you just, you know, it, very simply, you put it all in and you just reverse the whole thing. And
each individual photo.
Yeah. So, because the burlap, when it wraps first, it's wrapped in like a very cool like cross pattern. It's very intricate. Mm-hmm. So this is so much quicker to do just pulling those out after we braided them all on. So that's why we shot it in reverse. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool. It was it was about a 5 hour process altogether mm-hmm. for about 11 seconds
and
in the film.
There was a big debate on like how many frames per second are we going to do? Like, is it going to be 12? Is it going to be, what did it end up being?
I think it ended up being
eight
frames per second. Cause what we had to sort of explain to Mindfruit was that we want it to be choppy. They're perfectionists and they wanted it to look
super smooth and polished.
Yeah. And we had said like, no, this is based on a time lapse. So we want it to look like,
right.
We want it to look choppy. It's not supposed to be perfect. It's not supposed to look like it's happening in real time.
We want it to look organic. Again, very DIY. Mm-hmm. That's right. Kind of our aesthetic. Right. So
that's why we ended up on 8 frames per second.
So in a 16-day shoot, you spent 6 hours doing an 11-second shot in a stop-motion animation cocoon. Mm-hmm. Are you happy with how it turned out?
Yes, definitely.
It's very effective,
thank
I would say.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But that was, I mean, again, bold move.
Thank
and
you.
And you can do it because it's your dang film.
That's exactly. It.
Yeah.
No, a lot of people thought it might have been, you know, not the best use of time. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was really necessary, especially mm-hmm. for them to make that next leap in their relationship. Uh-huh. On their, we both cannot say the word relationship anymore.
Oh, yeah. I'm forever unable to pronounce that word. It's always relationship. Yeah.
No.
You might not be the only ones after this film gets out there.
Right on.
Okay, so last question was your first feature. Yeah. What do you know now that you wish you had known then?
Oh, man. I would just say speak up. You know, I think a lot of the, you know, and questions arise all the time on set. There's always going to be question. But I think as a duo, mm-hmm. you know, and establishing yourself as first-time film directors is, it's, there's always kind of a navigation happening there with your crew and things like that. So I would just say, yeah, speak up. If you have this idea bubbling up, let it out. Mm-hmm. And I think that has really changed me in this process. I think that I was always really careful about my questions. Not as a kid. As a kid, I was definitely, and my, all of my teachers can attest to this, I was, my hand was always up and I was always asking questions. But then something happens in college where you go, oh God, is everyone smarter around me? Like, you know, and, and then this self-judgment, all of that, and you get kind of, you know, precious with yourself. And but I would say that I've had a return to my younger self in this process, and I've realized that your questions really strengthen you.
And I should say also that something that we learned as we were going is that there is to decide when it's time to stop for a second, slow down, think. And then when it is time to go, when you're fighting
light,
sunlight, or, you know, you're running late and you know you have another scene to shoot and it might be a hard one. It might be time to go quick and move. And then sometimes it's time to tell everybody to hold on a second, to sit down and plan. There was, just specifically real quick, there was a shot where we were fighting light. It was a night shoot and the sun was about to come up. And
you can imagine on a 16-day shoot, I mean, there's only 16 days of that sweet spot, that like sunset golden hour. So, and we were only in the desert for 10 of those days or 11.
And so in this moment, it was nighttime and the sun was coming up and we were shooting the burlesque scene where Beck dances in the peanut butter and jelly costume. And it's pitch black outside and we have a spotlight shining right at our dancer. And she didn't know where she was on or off, out of frame. So we took a couple of takes and, you know, we get 2 minutes into the take and she leaves frame.
Amy Hessler, one of our dear friends, is the burlesque dancer.
And so, you know, everyone is, well, we got to go again. The sun's coming up. And it got to the point where eventually we had to say, everybody stop for 5 minutes. We're going to find out where the lines are. We're going to draw lines in the sand. She needs to know.
Literal line in the sand.
Because it's going to waste more time if we waste takes than it will to know for a fact that the next one won't be a waste.
Right.
And that was something that...
Great point.
That was something that we learned, you know, on the way, that there's a clear time where you have to decide whether to, you know, when it's time to stop and plan and when it's time to rush and go.
Yeah. With coyotes surrounding us, that was the time where we that was literally the time where we had to stop and say, okay, never mind the coyotes, never mind the sun coming up, we have to find out where she is. She needs to know where she is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And that also speaks to, I think, taking care of your actors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Well, you guys have been so candid, and I really appreciate all the insights that you shared and kind of
thank you so
the
much.
BTS.
You're such a pleasure. This was my favorite so far.
Yes.
So
thank you, and best of luck with the film. I can't wait till it gets wide release and it becomes The Labyrinth of the Kids Today.
Oh, my God.
I know. Can you imagine?
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
Thank you so much. Awesome. That's really sweet.
Thank you for listening. You can hear lots of other fascinating conversations on the art of filmmaking by finding the No Film School podcast in iTunes, and of course by visiting us at nofilmschool.com. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you can catch our Indie Film Weekly News show, which comes out every Thursday morning and fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. Meanwhile, you can reach me on Twitter @LizFilm, and we are on Twitter @NoFilmSchool. See you on Thursday.